Going to move on to IFRS 8 implementation reviews. So, April and Michael.
Yes, agenda paper 6.
Okay.
And we're in the process of our first post-implementation review relating to IFRS 8 operating segments. And we've entered into the second phase of the review in that back in July we published a request for information looking for experience that people have had with using the standard, whether that's applying it, using it, enforcing it, or in the case of your own experiences, actually using the information produced by it. And we're partway through the comment period related to that request for information that closes on the 16th of November. And during this time, we're undertaking a range of outreach activities to solicit views and experiences from people with their experience with the standard. It has put together a paper, and we have some questions for you that I will let April take us through.
Okay. When we met in February, we were at a rather earlier stage, as Michael said, and just to update you what's happened since then, at that time the due process requirement was that we performed a post-implementation review on any new or amended standard within 2 years of implementation. We had a lot of feedback about the 2 years. Some people say it's too early for investors to tell because there's not that much reporting out there yet. Other people say if you leave it any longer than that, preparers will have forgotten what they did. So this is the first post-implementation review that we're doing, and as we go through the process, the messages we receive will inform how we do other ones. So the purpose of the post-implementation review is to see, has it improved the financial reporting in this area? And if you look on page 2, you'll find that those are the effects that we affected the change to have. The old rules, as you recall, were quite defined. The reporting entity reported either the products and services it provided to its customers or geographies. It had two reporting bases. One was the primary, which had more disclosure. One was the secondary, which had less disclosure. Under the new rules, we're looking through the management eyes. For the management perspective, the benefit of that was that it would highlight the risks that were important. It helped investors, we hoped, to predict the profits and cash flows. And another important benefit would be that the commentaries, the investor presentations, and the financial statements themselves would all be in agreement. Now, when we met with you in February, we asked you to look at two examples, one in engineering and one in telcos, and there we found that the engineering example did actually agree, and that was helpful. But the telcos example, which was actually recommended to us by one of you, showed that there were different bases for how they manage the business and report the business, how they explain it to investors, and how they also explain it internally in the management commentary. So our first question for you today is, has that change in basis of segmentation into the management perspective, do you think it has achieved the benefits that are on page 3? Or are you more concerned about the concerns that were raised at the time that you'd get inconsistent segments between entities and that informal reorganizations would actually mean that you'd lose the trend information? So for that discussion, we've got a couple of extra examples on pages 4 and 5. The first one is food products. And we've taken as our example Nestlé compared with Associated British Food, and a couple of things which I found interesting about that. Nestlé uses the matrix presentation, which is a mix of geographies and products, and that wasn't allowed under IAS 14. In Nestlé's case, they've identified two or three separate product lines, like waters and nutrition, which they report yet separately, and the rest of the businesses they manage on a geographical basis. In fact, looking at most sets of financial statements, I think most people who use the matrix use it the other way round. In their home territories, they analyze things by products, And then in peripheral regions, they just have other regions managed geographically. And that's compared with Associated British Foods, which lists all the different products lines that they're in. Now, the businesses aren't necessarily that comparable, as you'll know. Nestlé's is very much a customer-facing, consumer retail-type business. Associated British Foods are also in terminal markets, so they're much more into commodities. And just for my personal amusement, I've noted that Associated British Foods actually also provide the geographical analysis as well with equal prominence, which was a requirement in the UK from the 1990s. So they have obviously just continued doing the same thing. And some of the preliminary feedback we've had from people is that actually a lot of people didn't change their reporting. They had geared up their internal reporting to such an extent based on IAS 14 that, for example, in the UK, more than 50% of the listed companies are doing exactly the same as they did beforehand. So anyway, how useful do you think the change to segmentation was? Have you noticed a change? Is it helping you in your work? That interesting.
Martin?
Well, let me first start that I think that the matrix is a confusing name, because with the matrix I think of countries on the horizontal and businesses on the vertical. And I think mixed is probably a better name than matrix. Apart from a bad name, or I think it is less insightful to mix them up. And it allows for, yeah, I think it's less insightful. Another comment is that what we've done, we've actually printed out a whole bunch of annual reports, operating segments, from Dutch companies, and we found out that a surprising number of companies just reported two segments. Well, I think it's disallowed to report one segment, but two is sounds like minimal, and somehow our conclusion was that actually current operating segment reporting is varies a lot. Some is really good. I can show you examples of Reed Elsevier in there, for example. They give three breakdowns: business, they give geography, and type of revenue, licensing and whatever, direct sales. So some companies know really well how to, under the current standard, provide excellent segment reporting, but quite a few don't. So somehow the standard does not safeguard, current standard doesn't safeguard a sufficient minimum level of granularity in the amount of operating segments. That's my assessment. And especially that's in the granularity of the operating segments. I think those that should, and what struck us most is that some companies are very well able to provide a decent granularity in the investor presentation, and when you look at the annual report, they only provide two, and the Shell company is one of those, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, which I think I will not comment on that. I think that. So somehow, I think. I don't. It's up probably to the ISB to see how to better safeguard the minimum level of granularity, because that's the thing where things go wrong. But also is a problem is that the companies have full freedom to provide through the eyes of management line items. But what struck us is that in the majority of cases, the end column matches exactly the IFRS number. So the total of any line item, of many line items, matches the IFRS number. And in many cases, there was no separate column where the reconciliation to IFRS was done. So what we observed is, in a high number of occurrences, there's no separate column for reconciliation to IFRS. This gives the analyst the impression that all the numbers are according to IFRS, but that's not required.
Well, is your interpretation that they are in accordance with IFRS and then there's no reconciliation, or they're not and somehow there's a fudge?
Yeah, what we worry about is that somehow through the eyes of management the numbers add up to an IFRS number, but we are not sure that the individual numbers indeed also are IFRS. It suggests somehow that it would, but we are not sure whether it is.
It seems remarkable that management, through the eye of management, numbers for these add up to IFRS, when if you look at any internal management report, they never add up to anything. There's always differences. So if it adds up, so it fudge is the most likely reason.
As you know, we did some research into different sectors, and also we found that what they were reporting was really very short, and I'm sure internally management is reporting much more information than was reported. And we look into a few companies in the retail sector, and the information was really poor compared, I'm sure, what they were reporting internally. Besides the point, and I agree with Martin, that there was no uniformity in the way how they were presenting. I mean, sometimes sector, sometimes geography, sometimes you go just to the operating line. I think there's a lot of leeway there on the management approach. If it would be a real management approach, yeah, you would get a lot of information, that would be great, but I think there is not really uniformity in the way how they are doing it. I'm saying it's the case for every company or for every sector. I found another company in the oil sector was really good information, so I cannot say it's across the board, but it's clear there's a lot of room for a lot of things there. That would be my message on this thing. You know, we did some research on a couple of sectors, very specific.
In terms of the number of segments, I'd be particularly interested in whether you've got any observations about whether there's been an increase or reduction from before IFRS 8 was introduced. But there's also the issue about the management approach and the flexibility, mm-hmm. whether that should be constrained and whether the added flexibility that we now have has been a good thing or a bad thing. Is it aligning with the way management thinks about the business, helping you sort of line up financial statements with the management commentary, or is it a negative aspect? So our review is, obviously IFRS 8 has changed practice, and has that change of practice, how has that worked? Have we got more segments less? Has it been beneficial or not?
Yeah, I think, again, conceptually, I think the management approach is should be good. I don't know to what extent companies are really implementing that they are doing that, because I said I think some companies have seen the segment reporting has really been reduced. I mean, segments right now are very, in a very, very large company, there are two segments. I don't know if someone mentioned one segment, two segments. That's what it is. It doesn't make any sense. So I think before with IIS 14, they had a more, constrained, but more, the guidelines was more defined. And, you know, they were supposed to adapt more to that. Now they have much more room to do things. I have seen proof. I'm not sure. In my case, or companies I have been looking at, I wouldn't say it has improved that much. The segment reporting is different, is what I would say. But obviously, I've been looking into a couple of sectors. I haven't been looking into every sector. So that's what I think.
Jane?
I would always be a bit sceptical about just leaving it to management. Not just because they're naughty, but because sometimes they believe their own propaganda too much. But just on the number of sectors, there's been this trend towards companies describing themselves as service companies, which means that they're seamless and it's soup to nuts. And I think this is an issue with telecoms, which Jack has described very well in other meetings. The fact is there are lots of different activities within there, but they see it as providing one service. So that's through their eyes, but it's actually not very helpful. And you wonder how well they're managing if they're not really facing up to the fact that actually they're selling handsets, and you know, and they have contracts, and you know, they're managing whatever. So I think that some, I think granularity is the word, and it's lacking. The other thing is you're not good, and this is speaks to what April was saying about what's the length of time you need to leave it. If you're looking for consistency over time, we haven't had it for very long, but where some companies have changed it. So, for example, British Aerospace changed their segment analysis in a way that sort of made it rather more difficult to look at exactly what was happening in their purely defence activities. Surprise, surprise, they did it when that business peaked. And maybe surprise, surprise, maybe they thought the problem was going to be solved for them by going in with the ADS anyway, which it hasn't been. So I think, again, I'm sure they genuinely believe that they want to move on from being seen as a defence company, and they wanted to play up all the various civil activities. But actually, from an analyst's point of view, trying to see, you know, how are they coping with their legacy operations in a declining market, that's not helpful. So there's, you know, you have those sort of granularity issues. The previous standard was more prescriptive on line items, and my perception is that there aren't enough line items, or there's a lot of inconsistency in what's reported in terms of from the net income statement. Cash flow chance would be a fine thing, or, you know, or balance sheet, whether you have net assets or not. I think that's just a few examples. So I suppose I'm pleading for a bit more prescription, because there isn't enough disaggregation and granularity.
Okay.
First point, I don't think you should rate the move to IFRS 8 through just a number of sectors, because I can give you 10 sectors. If they're completely irrelevant, who cares? I mean, you've improved statistics, but you delivered something that nobody could use. The key point for me would be to have the relevant sector. And let's be honest, I believe that the criteria used under the former standard was, for me, stronger. I believe you have too much flexibility in the way IFRS 8 allows you to report your business. I mean, I've seen some large companies in Europe suddenly ending reporting two of the biggest subsegments, making each 25% of the business, I mean, large ones, saying, hey, it's not only a country. So, and by the fact I have the individual accounts of the two different divisions, because they are legal entities, and I know they are using it, but they're not reporting it. That's the magic of, I think, of IFRS 8. And that's a weak point of it. I have in mind a company that was an early applicant of IFRS 8. So I think we've got 5.5 years of reporting under the IFRS 8. They have changed the definition of report of segment every year. Every year. And that's I've got difficulty to accept that they are changing strategy, that their business has really changed every year. I mean,
did they change on a regular basis under the old IAS 14? Well, under the previous standard, did they change their definition of segments on a regular basis as well?
I should go back 10 years ago. They had made some changes with mostly related to acquisitions, if I remember well. So changing the scope of the group, so something which does not frustrate me. But what they have done recently is typically subsegment C is now reporting to A and X, and then Z is moving to 50% to Z and Y, and then everything is mixed every year. So the international organization has a consequence of changing the reporting, giving outside to. So you have no continuity in space, which is very, very frustrating.
Do they restate comparatives when they
do this? 1 year. So my spreadsheet is a huge mess. A huge mess.
Martin, you said, I think, with you that you found situations where the analyst presentation, the analyst meetings, you discuss 10 segments. And then in the financial statements, you see 2 segments. How is that possible? How is that possible? If the analyst meeting focuses on 10 segments, I would guess this is because those segments are reported to the chief operating decision maker. Otherwise, they would not talk to analysts about it. And then, if that is reported to the CODM, it should be in the financial statement. So isn't there here an enforcement issue that we should take up with the enforcement agencies? Because I could not believe that you have such a big difference between what is told to analysts and what is told to the public.
They've actually brought that to us and asked for us to modify the definition of CODM.
Okay. But even let's assume it's a clear definition of CODM, because, and you can rely on what is going on between the analyst and the entity. I would hope to see the same level of granularity in the financial statements.
Okay. Shall I? There is no requirement in IFRS to mirror the segment information in the analyst presentation.
It is not explicit, but to me it is implicit that if something is reported to analysts, that is under the assumption that it is used by management.
Yeah. What I've heard.
CODM. Then it implies, to me, IFRS 8 implies that you would report it in the financial statements.
But the thing is, if we again look at the telecoms business, maybe indeed the rather weird view of the CODM. They pursue that view on the business in the financial report, and they say for the analyst presentation, yeah, wait a minute, those are analysts. Let's put together something for their eyes. Through the eyes of the analyst is not necessarily through the eyes of the CODM. So I think what it could be a misapplication of the standard which should be solved by enforcement, but it could equally be that indeed the CODM as defined in the standard only looks at 2 operating segments and 2 lines, operating profit and revenue. I mean, that could be the case. I mean, it's hard to falsify. It's hard to falsify even for a enforcer. It is very hard to falsify that the CODM is not looking the way they report.
I was an enforcer, which I was in the past, and maybe I'm a bias, too long an enforcer. I would start from the presumption that it could be, of course, demonstrated to be wrong. I would start from the presumption that if you show it to analysts, it's because the CODM would use it. Now, you could prove that you don't use it, it's just made up for the analyst, okay, but it would be to be demonstrated as being.
I think that it's pretty clear that the decision makers are using a lot higher granularity than 2, and they may in fact be using a lot more than they're preparing. But there's an interesting sort of logic argument, which is that preparers always push back so much about preparing stuff for users. And here we have, they have to get away from the enforcement argument, they have to be willing to, you know, we'll go through all of the extra accounting compiling work. So, which I think is a very heroic sort of set of assumptions. So I think we do have an enforcement problem if they're doing that. And the defense is very weak. It's we incur all these extra costs just for a bunch of analysts, and we don't even bother putting in the financial report. It's just for this meeting. Now, that's a heroic set of assumptions.
Saichi?
Yes. Japan basically copied and pasted the IFRS 8, and the new disclosure began just this past March. Before that, under the older standards, most of the bigger corporations show the segment information on the matrix or mixed basis, geography and products. And my friends were surprised this past spring to see that now many of them only show either the geography or product-based information. They think that the companies, by reading the new standards, think or thought that only showing the either the geography or the product information will be enough. However, they think it is highly unlikely that the management only look at the geography or product basis. Most likely, they will look at both information by making in order to make management decisions. Although emphasis could be a little different. So what they hope right now is that the ISB, after this review, will modify the IFRS 8, perhaps by annual improvement, and to show the little guidance or example, so that strongly encourage the companies to show the information on geographical and product matrix basis.
Okay, Keith, Eric?
I just want to go back to the point I made in the earlier discussion about this is a great opportunity to look at something that have been put in place and how do you test what people are getting. And I think we are somewhat tainted because we're using the notion of chief operating decision maker and certain things because we've been too close to it for just too long. But it would be useful if you take two people that just got out of, got their CFA license, never analyzed a company, never heard about CPDM, OPDM, or anything that we think about. Say, you're getting this thing. What do you want to know, right? What do you want to understand? So I'm just trying to use it in a very simplistic fashion. Forget everything I know about accounting and look at what presented in front of me. So one issue, I'm looking at two companies or two industries, and I say, I cannot compare those two companies because their decision maker is deciding things differently. So one thing you said, it's not comparable among entities. Compromise, you can make this compromise, but it's non-comparable. If it's comparable, you want to give me different information or create a template. So you threw intra-company comparability out of the water. I think that's what you're going to get some of the feedback from those folks. So yes, I can compare peers on one level, but I cannot compare it. And it goes back to some discussion about disaggregated information and conceptual framework and how you want to report it. The second question would be, is it really how the companies manage their business? Hopefully, yes. Hopefully, they don't give me two because they want to save ink or save paper, because that's the way they really manage the business. So assuming from a compliance standpoint, they give you the right information, that's how they manage the business, it is useful to compare business year over year. Now, is it useful for me to see the grocery increase by 1% or 5% or decrease? It leads to the next question. Now, do you really understand the drivers of revenues? What drives an increase or decrease in grocery? It is irrelevant. So what you're providing is very, very little. You're providing me some hints about what to ask, but if you ask me whether this information is vividly useful, if you tell me the grocery increased by 5%, sugar by 3%, but I cannot compare it with companies with the same industry, same areas, because they don't present it the same way, I would start thinking, if you start testing it, you'll see that there's much more the analysis than what is provided here, and at best you provided some cues. In this spirit, either way you go, you provided a grossly incomplete picture, in my view.
How would we ever achieve comparability?
I don't know if you need to achieve comparability, right? We're describing some certain elements of panacea. I would think some of the elements here would be tied to, if what you really wanted to present is certain drivers of the business, at subsets of the business and what's the revenue generators, I need some narrative around it. What drives your revenues in groceries? It could be because, your European subsidiary has been doing very well, or you're North American, or cost of, currency things have changed the way you've done business, or a bunch of other things. But in and of itself, this thing is nice. But look, from an analytical standpoint, in and of itself, I think it has very, very little relevance, other than giving me a prompt, hey, raise a question mark. That's, unless somebody here has some silver bullets, they can tell me how they can analyze it. And say, I can see it in there. It's immediately evident to me what the driver of the business. I can project how the grocery will be doing. I know exactly what regions they're exposed to. If any of my peer analysts here say that this is great, they can analyze it. No, I'm ready to take private lessons.
What are you suggesting we do? Harry, what do you suggest we do with this?
I would think, either way, you can either create a comparative template and then have a company transcribe what are the drivers of this particular segment and how they think
about comparative templates. Sorry.
I'm saying either you put comparative templates saying, if you're in a particular business, describe the line of business, and we would expect some either regional things and lines of business. But I'm not going there. I'm just saying I'm okay with where you are now, but I think it needs to be expanded. It needs to be expanded to provide additional description of what drives the revenues in each particular segment.
But isn't that the purpose of an MD&A?
Not necessarily an MD&A, because otherwise you're going to say that the breakers of profit and loss in an income statement is an MD&A. So in my mind, what drives sector profitability for the past period? And if you argue it's MD&A, it's okay, it's an MD&A, but in most cases, if it's provided an MD&A, I'm indifferent. But the reality, if financial statements are standalone and they are not provided with an MD&A, that's going to be missing. And I don't see it always in the MD&A in the context of segments. And if you put it in one place, it provides, then the other argument would be, don't provide me this at all. You can provide this in the MD&A as well. So again, in my mind, is packaging and how you do it. And if one relates to the other, and I need the other information in order to infer things from here, I would argue that they belong together. Whether they belong together in the statement or belong in the MD&A, I'm indifferent.
That's a very, very good input for our work on the conceptual framework and disclosure framework. Because what you say that the segment information is just at the border between MD&A and financial statements. And to make it really useful, you need more. And the question is whether more is in financial statements or in the MD&A. And you say probably should be in the financials because it should be standing alone. And that's an interesting point. Should the financial statements stand alone to understand the performance of the entity? That's a point we should discuss in the disclosure framework.
So,
Jack first.
One of the arguments I've heard in all these debates is that the problem was not the standard, the problem was the implementation. I don't agree with that, because if you got a too flexible standard, you will have a lot of implementation standard problem. You create them, in fact. I mean, remember 15 years ago about extraordinary profit, income, whatever. All the bad stuff was below, all the good one was. Finally, we closed the door, a little bit tougher, and that's fine. Here we've got something that's too flexible, and this is a problem. And we create implementation problems. That's the point. I mean, management approach for something which is, I believe, so important for real analysts. I mean, it's the one place, segment reporting, where we put our knowledge of the sector. I mean, and having something that you have too much flexibility is not a good recipe for having good food. I can give you an example. I have a company which recently decided to report only one segment, previously two. Very strangely, in the press release, they're disclosing a segment which is not in the financial statement. Strange. Very strange.
Go back to
your old job. You've got a big opportunity.
That sounds like a problem with the application of the standard, not a problem with the way the standard is written.
I disagree with that. When you've got a standard which is very flexible, you will see people using the flexibility. And that's the case with the standard. Then also remember that in the process, one of the safeguard of using too much flexibility is also providing, let's say, strong rules to the auditors. If you base the power on the management decides, then you remove this safeguard. This is important also.
I think it's important to differentiate between a sort of a standard which where the principle is broad but enforcement is weak, or one where the principle is so broad that even strong enforcement can't bring people sort of sufficiently into line. And it may be that we have a problem here in terms of sort of defining the chief
as he called, chief decision maker. Maybe that is the wrong way to frame this particular principle, and maybe that needs a little more work to prevent this sort of wriggle room, but still leave it as a principle, because what we don't want is rules basis. But I think that would be the first thing to really try and identify. You know, is there a problem with a principle that is, practically speaking, too broad to be clearly sort of applicable, or actually is it a problem with enforcement? Because I don't think, I don't want a much tighter defined standard simply as a way of removing the problem with enforcement. So we could have hard rules with no room for manoeuvre, and you wouldn't need enforcers at all, essentially, unless you're just going to have companies that simply broke the rules. So you can say to people, you drive at 30 kilometres an hour, if you do 29 or 31, you're booked. And that's simple. You're either doing 30 or you're not, or you have a system that says sort of in principle you drive in a reasonable way, or you have something that's sort of between those two rather ends of the spectrum. So I think that's one of the key things that we need to identify here with this sort of post-implementation review, is it a problem with the way the standard, the principle and standard have been framed? Does it need to be slightly tighter? Or in reality, is it simply people are just driving a coach and horses through the standard and being allowed to by their local enforcers?
Which do you think it is?
I suspect it's a mixture, but I suspect more of the problem is with the enforcement rather than with the principle. I don't have any real evidence for that as such. That's just my personal prejudice.
I'm not saying I don't want flexibility. I do understand. But the problem is when you compare the definition of a segment between IS 14 and IFRS 8, I believe there is too much flexibility. There was in IS 14, let's be honest. I mean, but now you've handed the power to the management. If it's flexible, they can play with it. And in fact, they are playing with it. Let's be honest. And part of the game is, for me, my understanding is that inside the company, the auditors are preventing also to act also because the standard put the power in the end of the management on the standard.
Yeah.
And that's important.
I think the standard needs to be revised in a way that is more forward-looking or reflects the times. I mean, the old standard, when there were many more companies that were either conglomerates or combined sectors, you could do some of the parts, and what the way they would do the divisions would be more like, you know, the subsector, the market subsectors, and you could apply different PEs to different parts of the business. Now you've got this sort of focus thing. And you've got technology companies, telecom companies. They say we are. That would be their justification. Would be we are just one sector. That's what we are. We are one segment. So I think it's how to get at the granularity in terms of, you know, do we want to? How do you encourage them to give information by different types of customer? Is it retail or wholesale or low and high margin business? So pharma can be quite good. You know, patented businesses, high margin, OTC not so much. Diagnostics different again. So that's, you know, they've moved on. They've moved on that way. Even though they've been a focused sector forever, so it's, I don't know how you get the standard to encourage a drill down in a different, slightly different industrial environment.
There's a bit of an overlap with revenue recognition, and part of the disclosure enhancements in that project is a more granular disaggregation of revenue along the lines of what you're saying. So even though it might be one segment, there would still be further disaggregation by retail, wholesale, types of customer, geography, whatever is relevant.
Yeah, I'd see those two.
To sort of try to pull the conversation along, I'm going to oversimplify, so nobody shoot me for oversimplification. But ultimately what we're doing is we're applying a multiple, I apologize for being simplistic, on something.
Yeah.
And that the craft is what is the multiple and what are we applying it on. But that's coming out of the financial statements. We also need to understand how the drivers of the business, and I think that's coming out of the MD&A. So that's sort of to the conversation of, you know, where the lines go. What we haven't heard today, first of all, is nobody said sometimes when you listen to these conversations, what people don't say is as important as what they said. And what we didn't say was it hasn't improved. So now the question is, why hasn't it improved? And the question is it an enforcement problem or is it a standard problem? And to this, we all know there's enforcement's an issue, but to the standard issue, it would seem that in the eyes of the decision maker, turns out to not be maybe the best definition for what we wanted. I actually think if we actually got what management really is managing, that's probably the way we should analyze it. But clearly we don't seem to be getting that. And the auditors are allowing it to go through. So maybe the problem was in the definition, the principle's right, but how you execute it from principle to the standard may not have, maybe it wasn't quite as good as you'd hoped.
Are we just being too restrictive on chief operating decision maker? Is that the problem? Or maybe we should focus more on what's communicated to investors. Somebody mentioned press releases and the like. Maybe that should be the presumption of what goes to management.
I think you could use rebuttable, it's a rebuttable argument. But if you say to the auditor, I'm managing two segments and that's it, but I'm reporting four to my investors, that's a dead ringer for there are more than two. If your entire internal accounting system reports six or seven, then you have to ask, the auditor asks us, well, wait a minute, we see the internal stuff coming up. This isn't how you're actually reporting it internally, therefore. So I think the people who may have failed us here are the auditors.
Can I just say that I think listening to people talking about this sort of in different areas, and perception varies enormously. There are some jurisdictions or some forums where investors are particularly skeptical about preparers and others where they're less skeptical. But where it seems to work best or well is where the operating segment itself gives us sort of a total figure in the financial statements, and then the MD&A provides much, much more detail, which is entirely consistent with those segments as laid down in the financial reports or financial statements. And in those cases, investors seem to have more confidence in the MD&A because it agrees with what they see as being audited statements, so that seems to be the benefit of that. I don't know if it's worth at this stage going on to question two.
I just add something. There's something rather important from my point of view in what Robert said. Basically, we're putting a PE on something. Making a valuation of something. How can you, in some cases, put a PE on a business that does not exist in the outside world? I mean, if you are reporting segment X, and this activity, let's call it an activity, does not exist on the stock market. There has been no M&A activity on this business for the last 20 years, but it's the way the information is provided. This is not segment reporting.
I guess this starts getting to question two, doesn't it?
Sorry, but one of the goals of the segment reporting is to have information that is usable from the external point of view. I mean, maybe the management might be organized. Sometimes I have doubts. Sometimes I have more than doubts. But if the information provided is not usable because you cannot make anything on it.
So you're saying that splitting revenue by grocery and sugar isn't usable because there is no pure sugar company quoted and there's no pure grocery company quoted?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that. But from my point of view, I would guess this would be a relevant the disclosure by Associated British Food, because the business of sugar and grocery and agriculture, I suspect, have different driver, different capital intensity, different perhaps regulation. I mean, I would be comfortable with that. I guess there are some standalone business, and I guess also that there is some M&A activity over the last 10 years with sugar company. It does exist. So I would have some reference. But I have some example with segment disclosure where I have seen no M&A activity with such a definition for the last 20 years. So it's nice segment. I have an EBITDA, but what multiple should I put on it? It's segment Z. Okay.
But then segment reporting be then saying, okay, requirement that it should be enable a user to put in value on the different segments, that is how I understand you. But that is, I think, very difficult because even companies would not have this information and they're not split in this that you be able to put price on the operating segments, even from an M&A transaction or a fair value on the market.
What we're being asked to do is we're saying, no matter what type of analysis you're doing, we're asked, what is this company worth? If this company is one business, we can apply one set of drivers and one set of business assumptions. The moment it's two segments, we've got to actually value this thing as two, and if it's got 10 very different segments, we really probably... being strained, but you probably so whether there is a market there or not, if you have the answer is it is our job and it's the only way we can value dissimilar things is to put value on the pieces
because well, you can't that, do yeah.
so
I understand that, but I understand not regarding to have, because you can do an evaluation. If you know the future cash flows of that business, you can also do a valuation of this segment, even if you don't have in the market a similar company.
I think Jacques' problem is that these segments are arbitrary. They're not the real segments, or they're arbitrary segments, or they're fictitious segments, and that it's not really being driven by this.
I mean, you cannot put a multiple on whatever it's. Earnings, cash flow, EBITDA. Yep. If this business has not generated any price anywhere in the world, either on the stock market or in M&A deal, I mean, I can make DCF, but I can value my dog 1 billion with a DCF. I mean, let's be honest. Well, everybody knows that.
But that's not a problem with the accounting, is it?
I mean,
I know that.
Okay, you've done impairment test.
That's a direct lead into the next question, and I disagree with you because here's the problem.
Okay,
we live by comparability. So you can put a value of your dog as being a billion, but I'm going to compare it to the value of other dogs.
And Two billions?
Well, I'm going to just say, wait a minute. If you know, a dog varies between free at the pound or maybe 1,000 pounds for a thoroughbred. So that's the range using comparability. This is why comparability is so important. And therefore, with all due respect, there's no way your dog is worth a billion.
No, but I could prove it using, I mean, pure cash flow information you were referring, without having the real price of a market somewhere in the world. I mean, with a DCF, with plain, you can do whatever you want.
But you can't define segments based on what analysts want to have as valuation information.
Agree,
you have
the,
to start
at the end,
else.
I believe there should be a sanity check. Is this information usable by an external
viewer? Yeah, but I think the information's always usable, but it's only usable if you've got comparability.
I think that's the key.
Yeah. And you know, the example you were mentioning about a company that's changing its segment disclosures every period, now that's somewhere where that's either illustrative of a standard which is too loosely worded because it allows that sort of flipping-flopping, or it's illustrative of a standard which is fine but is not being properly enforced.
Or management that has no idea how to run their business.
Yeah. I mean, that's three codes.
Possibly, yeah.
Martin?
Yeah.
We live in a very valued environment.
The picture emerges that all analysts, I think we're clearly a question two now, I guess. just for sure. All analysts, the base for most analysts is the sum of the parts of the business. Well, to me, that's not the case at all. The basis for my modeling is the full, I reproduce the entire financial statements in my model. Entire cash flow statement, balance sheet, P&L. And I use the operating segment information to model margin development and growth rates. My perception is that many analysts use that approach as well. And I just wonder, how can you put multiples on the usually so superficial operating segment information?
So how do you model a business that really has two different pieces? And I'll take a simple telecom company where there's a wireline business that is basically stable, yeah. and I'm simplifying, and a cell business that's increasing. How do you model that as a whole? You've got to model that as two pieces. So you've got to go and look at your operating piece, and implicitly somewhere you've got two sections to your model.
So what I do, as I just told, I reproduce the entire financial statements. And I take a growth rate for the one business and look how sizable that part of the business is. And I take a growth rate for the other part of the business and I look at how sizable that part
is. I think the question is, if you forgive me, the question is slightly flawed because it's saying how do you value the business? And actually it should really be saying is how do you analyze the business, because you analyze the business first and then you make a separate decision as to how you value it. So you might analyze the business first on a segment-by-segment basis, different margins, different growth rates, come to one overall cash flow number, forecast that overall cash flow number, and do one valuation, but you've used segment information to get there. I might do different analysis of different segments and then put individual segment profits on different multiples to get to my valuation.
And by the way, but
answer to the question, and come back on this if you think I'm wrong, Martin, but I think everybody analyzes businesses on a segment-by-segment basis.
Mm-hmm. That's where we put value, because we know the business. If you've got one consolidated thing, I mean, with very different dynamics, like the one Robert was referring to, it's where we can put that judgment. I mean, fixed line is declining by 1%. That's a reasonable guess, because I know the industry, I know the competition. But if I've got a whole single line revenue plus 2%, but how did I create that? What is behind this 2%? Perhaps 6% in mobile and minus 2% in fixed. So
the piece that we're not saying here, that we're employing it all the way through the piece, is that we're going to model this based upon the information they gave us. And if they didn't spread out in our example, wireline and cell, what do? You make a wild guess about what's happening I'm pretty sure wireline's going down. Therefore, at best, it's flat, and then all my growth is in cell. And you know, we're going to do this. And if we don't know, and this is inherently different than preparers. If we do not know, we'll guess and we'll put a number in. And you tell that to a preparer, and they flip out on you.
So that's exactly what I did last evening with a European telco. I had to guess to put a price.
That's what preparers should be doing. You know, the board should be saying, you know, do these different types of activity fit together? Are we getting the most out of them, or should we be selling them to someone else who'd get more out of them? So actually, I'm rather worried at the concept that preparers aren't doing this sort of analysis.
But any large company...
They're just not telling us about it.
Well, exactly. Any large company has a team that's looking at the individual businesses, and somebody is doing the calc. Even if they're not planning to sell, somebody is actually calculating. There's some poor person that's calculating, should we sell this line of business this year? So there's no question they're doing it internally. If anybody that we think is large, there's a couple of people quietly sit in the corner evaluating the pieces all the time.
Doing it by country, you know, is it worth staying in that little...
Well, they'll do it by what they can sell off. So if they feel they can sell off a country, they might do it as a country. If they feel that they can only sell off product lines, they'll do it by product lines. And that's what should be driving. But that's in management eyes. Because they're going up to the chief executive and says, oh, by the way, we're our debt rating is under threat. Let's sell off the, you know, the fictitious country, you know, product line. So that it's got to be there somewhere.
Okay, very wide-ranging conversation. Has that been some help?
Yes.
Can I just ask a quick question? Because in what occurrences would, through the eyes of management, always be more relevant than a risk-reward breakdown? Because risk-reward sounds by nature to be very, very in line with how analysts tend to look at business. And it's the risk and reward characteristics are very different. Should they be in one segment anyway?
To answer your chance, I'd like to sort of. I worked for a telephone company where there was a small group of people that actually had to be CFAs. It was part of the requirement. And what those people were doing was they're analysts. And all they were doing was they're evaluating the pieces. One would hope that the people who are picking out the segment, there should be in a large company, there's a bunch of real analysts, people that we would recognize as analysts, mm-hmm. who are doing the valuation, and they know the business. They know this piece, these pieces go together and make a coherent business. These pieces go together.
That was not the question.
No.
The question was risk and reward, but I don't know how to do risk and reward. If
it
I've got
to be
pieces,
risk and reward, wasn't it?
Yes.
It used to be a risk and reward.
But
a segment.
I'm going to call a halt because I think the big question, and I think we need some coffee and get some drink for the rest of the afternoon. But I'm sure this will come back and we'll have another opportunity on IFRS 8 at some stage. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, how do you